I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Winona Howder, has run a family farm in the rural Bull Run Mountains of Virginia, 40 miles from Washington, D.C., since 1997. She and her husband feed 500 families each season with organic vegetables as part of a community support agriculture program, or a CSA. Her father bought the farm back in 1963. And as you can imagine, farming is near and dear to her heart. Winona Howder is a huge advocate for the local food movement, but she says it's not enough to solve the country's food crisis. Just a handful of corporations control our food system from the seeds to our dinner plates. She writes, quote, "The food system is in a crisis because of the way that food is produced and the consolidation and organization of the industry itself. Solving it means we must move beyond the focus on consumer choice to examine the corporate, scientific, industrial, and political structures that support an unhealthy system. Combating this is going to take more than personal choice and voting with our forks. It's going to take old-fashioned political activism." End quote. Winona Howder is executive director of Food and Water Watch. That's a D.C.-based watchdog organization focused on corporate and government accountability relating to food and water. She has worked extensively on food, water, energy, and environmental issues at the national, state, and local level. And her new book is called Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. And Winona joins me here in studio. Hi, thank you for coming in.
I'm so pleased to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. Now, you have such an interesting background because not only do you run Food and Water Watch, we've had a number of local staffers on our show, but you're also a farmer. And you say that you decided to write this book and really delve into the history of the food system, because that's really the only way we're going to fix it.
That's absolutely right. I think that there is a lot of emphasis on subsidies and looking at single issues that are causing the problems with our dysfunctional food system. And so I decided that it was time to be a bit of a contrarian and to really look at the deeper structural issues that nobody's talking about, like the consolidation and the small number of companies that are really controlling our food system and who really benefit from food policy, from farm policy. So one of the things that I do in the book is really look at the history of our food system and how we got to where we are today.
And that's what I find so fascinating about this, is the history, because we don't talk that much about it. Before we go there, talk a little bit about the local food movement, because you are an advocate of it, but you say it's not a solution.
Well, I think it's a really exciting modern phenomenon that people really are going back to being excited about local food. And I know I'm very lucky in that I inherited my family's farm very close to a large urban market. And my husband actually runs the farm. But the local food movement can't feed everyone. It means that there are some people who can benefit, those people who are excited, who have the financial and educational background to appreciate it. But we have a very large population, and we have a lot of health problems related to the way people eat. And we want to be able to have a food system that feeds everyone, not just a few people. So I hope that the local food movement can actually lead to politicizing people.
Talk more about that, because you are in Northern California on your book tour, and the local food movement is huge here. I mean, really, really big. We've got the farm-to-table restaurants. There are events constantly, you know, from up in Mendocino to Monterey. There's so much behind this. So can you talk a little bit more about your thoughts on it,
yeah,
and why you think we need so much more than that?
Well, I think if we had a vibrant movement like we see here in Northern California, everywhere, we would be farther along, because we would have lots of people who were already educated about the food system, and it would be a lot easier to make the political changes. But we need to actually do organizing in communities across this country, because we have a government that is allegedly a democracy, and we need to make sure that people are activated across the country, not just in Northern California. California is blessed also with a very good climate. People are very fortunate here to be able to get produce year-round. But, you know, something interesting that I found in writing Foodopoly is that even a state like Montana used to be self-sufficient with food, with local food production. Mm. It was canned, and it wasn't fresh produce, but they managed to feed themselves and sustain the population. So I think that the local food movement, if you have a marketplace that actually allows farmers to reach into the market, it can be very exciting, but in most places in the country, that's just not the case.
So what happened in Montana?
Well, what happened in Montana is what happened to our entire food system. Mm-hmm. From the 1930s, when we actually had good farm policy, part of the New Deal legislation actually made it possible for farmers to make a living. Commodity farmers were able to sell grains and make an income that was on par with the rest of the population. And this was done by making the marketplace work and not to have overproduction, because overproduction is really the bane of farmers. So there was a grain reserve program. Marginal land was taken out of production, and that meant that there weren't too many crops and farmers could make a living. But those who benefit from having overproduction and those who feared farmers because of their political power started organizing in the 1940s. And some of these business leaders formed an organization called the Committee for Economic Development. It was actually formed in 1942. And their goal was to get, and this is a quote from their materials, get those boys off the farm, because they were looking for cheap labor for factories. And these business laborers also feared the political power of farmers who had been joining together with the labor movement since the time of the Civil War. And they feared that once they came back from being soldiers in World War II, they wouldn't be satisfied with the political system. And so they wanted to get people out of rural areas. And, you know, this wasn't a conspiracy. This was people of like class and like mind getting together and developing a strategy. So they began chipping away at these programs that allowed farmers to actually make a living. This began because of their lobbying in the 1950s. They made the first changes to farm policy. And in every farm bill from 1950 to the mid-1990s, these programs were slowly chipped away so that farmers began suffering. The final axe fell in 1996, and this was really to get in line with World Trade Organization policies. Now, these same men who had started the Committee for Economic Development were also big adherents of so-called free trade. They wrote and lobbied about the need to have a free market where even food would be outsourced. And in fact, their vision pretty much came true for the world during the debate about the World Trade Organization and NAFTA and all of the bilateral trade agreements. So in 1996, the Farm Bill, which is legislated every 5 years or so, was a very draconian farm bill was passed. It was called Freedom to Farm. Farmers very quickly started calling it Freedom to Fail because it completely deregulated farm policy. It took away the programs that actually allowed farmers to make a living. It took away the grain reserve, took away the program that took acreage out of production, and so there was massive overproduction of corn and soy. Very quickly, farms started overproducing, and the price of crops like corn and soy plummeted. By 1998, corn was 50% the price that it had been a couple of years before. Soy was 25% less. Farms started going out of business because small farms, medium-sized farms, run on a very small margin. So the subsidies that we hear so much about were passed first as temporary solutions in 1998, and then they were made permanent in 2002. This was about allowing overproduction for the big companies that benefit from having low prices. And these are the companies that are the real beneficiaries. So let's look at the soda industry.
And just on this point, because you bring up subsidies, and we're talking with Winona Howder about her new book, Foodopoly. She's executive director of Food and Water Watch. You just brought up a number of things there. But on the subsidies, this part of your book really caught my attention because I often say, we need to spend more time talking about subsidies. And can you talk a little bit about your argument? Where do you stand on subsidies?
Right. Well, you know, I'm not defending the subsidy system, but it is a symptom of a dysfunctional food system. It's not the cause. We could do away with subsidies tomorrow. We would not fix the food system. It would just cost the junk food industry a slightly larger amount of money. It would not prevent junk food from being produced. So the issue with subsidies begins with bad USDA statistics. And remember Mark Twain always said lies, damn lies, and statistics? Well, this is the truth. The USDA greatly exaggerates the number of farmers. They say that there are 2.2 million farmers in the U.S. Probably they're embarrassed about how few farmers there are and how their policies have led to the demise of farms. Really, there are under a million full-time farmers, but they count operations like my friend's flower growing business. She makes under she sells under $1,000 a year. And this isn't her bring home amount of money that she brings home. This is her actual sales. She's counted as a farmer, even though she has a retirement income and probably makes more money than most people do. My other neighbor who grows grapes, retired from the military, has a fine pension, is growing grapes as a hobby. He's counted as a farmer. He makes under $10,000 in sales every year. So a third of the farmers that the USDA counts have sales of under $1,000. Two-thirds of those farmers they count have sales of under $10,000. When you count all of those people as farmers, and then you look at subsidies, it greatly exaggerates the number of people towards the top that are getting subsidies. In reality, 82% of small and mid-sized farms get this government payment. And what's really shocking, the average income is just over $19,000 of these farmers. And half of that money is from the direct payment, or not just direct payments, but the government subsidies. And if we change the system and get rid of these subsidies before we fix farm policy, we're going to lose those small and mid-sized farms. We already are. Right now, there are 115,000 very, very large farms, the ones people think about. And of course, yes, they are subsidized as well. But what happens when those small and mid-sized farms go out of business, they're absorbed by these larger farms. And so it actually leads to more consolidation, not to the diversity we want. We need to save those farms so we can actually transition them, which is why we need to add antitrust law to our agenda of the good food movement.
We're speaking with Winona Howder, author of Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. Winona is executive director of Food and Water Watch. That's a D.C.-based watchdog organization focused on corporate and government accountability relating to food and water. And Winona has a number of events coming up over the next couple of days. Tonight, she'll be at the Ferry Plaza Book Passage in San Francisco at 5:30. Tomorrow, she will be at Berkeley City College at 7:30 in the East Bay. And then Thursday, she'll be at the Capitola Book Cafe at 7:30. And on Saturday, she'll be at the Sunrise Center in Corte Madera, 4 o'clock. And you can find more information about these events at yourcallradio.org. And I'll repeat them throughout the show with addresses. Winona Howder, her husband runs a farm. They feed 500 families a year. She's a big advocate of the local food movement, but says that is not enough to solve our food crisis. Voting with our fork is not enough. We need good old-fashioned activism. So what questions do you have about the corporate control of our food system? What about the history of and how we got here? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And what questions do you have about the corporations that control our food system? She writes that 20 food corporations produce most of what we eat, even the organic brands. And actually, this past election, a lot of information came to light about the organic brands that are owned by multinationals because they opposed the GMO labeling law. So what questions do you have about our food supply? What concerns you the most? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you're involved in the local food movement or if you support it, what are your thoughts on Winona's argument? You can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. So you brought up a lot about history, and I want to go back there because this Committee for Economic Development really reminded me of the Koch brothers. As you said, in 1942, several businessmen, including Paul Hoffman, president of Studebaker, William Benton, the inventor of modern consumer research polling, and Marion Folsom, an Eastman Kodak executive, got together to promote their agenda. Can you just talk more about this Committee for Economic Development and what don't most of us know about this?
Well, this was an organization that most of the titans of business of the day joined, and they got together. They had regular meetings. They worked with economists in different universities. They put out reports, and they lobbied. And in those days, we didn't have the lobby shops in Washington that we do today. It was more of people getting together at business clubs, at their social clubs, at social gatherings, and doing that kind of lobbying. So in 1962, the Committee for Economic Development put together a report called An Adaptive Program for Agriculture, where they really laid out their agenda of getting young men out of farming. They talked about getting rid of training programs in rural areas, making programs available to give these young men, and it was young men in those days, skills so that they could go into urban areas and work in factories. They wanted programs to help move young men into these areas. And at the same time, the U.S. Department of Agriculture adopted the same agenda and began changing the agriculture programs. About the same time, the Committee for Economic Development also wrote a report on trade. And these reports were written with a large number of influential economists from the best universities of the day. The trade report talked about offshoring of food, and it really laid out the agenda that came forward with the creation of the World Trade Organization and that we see today with all of the bilateral agreements that are being written and that the U.S. is promoting. So this was an agenda that really changed farming, and it took many years to bring it into full force, but we're living with the outcomes today.
The other part of the story you tell, and you say most of these stories have been erased from public consciousness, especially the history of the post-World War II farm movement. You write that so many farmers fought back against all of this to form things like the Farm Alliance, the National Farmers Union. They organized, they ran candidates, they joined with progressive allies and labor and social justice movements. You write farmers were still a large and vital political force that had to be reckoned with in the 50s. They were willing to take militant action to protect their families and their communities.
This is so true. Most people, unless you live in one of the Midwest towns where this happened, don't realize that farmers
became so outraged in the 50s that they would take their tractors, their cars into the urban areas where the state legislature met or where there would be a meeting of agribusiness. They would dump their milk. They took dramatic action that would seem very radical today. So there's no doubt that this business group also wanted to do something about the political activism in rural communities. And in the 40s, more than 50% of the population lived in rural areas. Today, it's about 16%. So what's actually happened is these policies have devastated rural America, and it's led to the political conservatism that we see in these areas today. Because when people are suffering from economic hardship, it's easy to trot out issues that distract them, whether it's gay rights, whether it's abortion, or any of these issues that are social issues that rural communities are basically disciplined with.
We have a comment on our Facebook page about Ezra Taft Benson, Eisenhower's Secretary of Agriculture, and you write extensively about him. You say that he was set on destroying the New Deal program for agriculture, measures that had been designed to ensure fair farm prices. The large and powerful grain trading, food processing, banking, and industrial giants had been conspiring to cut the cost of grains and to drastically reduce the number of farm families. Talk a little bit about him and where did Eisenhower stand on these issues? Because what we always hear about Eisenhower is his quotes about the military-industrial complex, not so much about farming and agriculture.
Well, I'm not sure how engaged the president was actually in agriculture, but this was all taking place at the Department of Agriculture, and we know that Eisenhower was very business-friendly, that he had been put into office by business interests, and so I'm sure that there was some agreement. But Benson was a very ideological individual. He really opposed the populism that he saw in rural areas, and he really had it in for farmers, I must say. And he really wanted to reduce the size of farms. There was a USDA report that said that 84% of the food is at this time was produced by one-third of farms, and really all of this other land and farms should be put to some other more productive use. So all of the policies under the Benson Department of Ag were directed at vertical integration and making farms larger. Now, his protege was Earl Butz, who people who are my age may remember in the 70s. He is the Secretary of Agriculture under Nixon, who told farmers, get big or get out. And so policies continued degenerating under these very radical secretaries of agriculture, radical in the sense that they were not about protecting rural communities or having a good food system. It was all about making food production more efficient.
We're speaking with Winona Howder, author of the new book, Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. She writes about corporate control of our food system. Just 20 food corporations produce most of the food we all eat, even the organic brands. Four large chains, including Walmart, control more than half of all grocery store sales. We've been talking about the history, how we got here, and coming up after the break, we'll talk about what this means for us today and in the future. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
This week, SF Jazz will celebrate the opening of the new SF Jazz Center, capping the celebration Wednesday's opening night concert, that's tomorrow night, hosted by Bill Cosby, and featuring performances from McCoy Tyner, Chick Corea, Joshua Redman, Bobby Hutcherson, Esperanza Spalding, Mary Stallings, John Handy, Pete Escovedo, the SF Jazz Collective, and many more. The event is sold out, the opening night concert celebration, but you can hear it live here on KALW. From the SF Jazz Center, 8 to 11 tomorrow night, or watch the video webcast at kalw.org. And congratulations to all our friends and our partners at SF Jazz.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will mark the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the historic Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion in the United States. Even though the majority, we're talking 70% of the population, according to a new Wall Street Journal NBC poll, support abortion, state laws restricting abortion are on the rise. So what explains this? How has the status of reproductive rights changed over the last four decades? That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with Winona Howder about her new book, Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. Winona is executive director of Food and Water Watch, and she and her husband run an organic family farm in Northern Virginia that provides vegetables and a CSA to over 500 families. She argues that while the local food movement has done so many positive things for health, it is not the solution to solve the country's food crisis. We need to do a lot more than just vote with our fork. We need to engage in good old-fashioned political activism. So what are your thoughts on this? If you're involved in the food movement in Northern California or anywhere else, we'd love to hear from you. What concerns you about what we're facing today, and what questions do you have about our food supply? We often talk about GMOs. We talk about corporations, multinationals or owning organic brands. What are your thoughts on what we are currently facing and what concerns you? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or leave a comment on our website. And if you're a farmer, we'd love to hear from you. What changes have you seen over the years? You can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And again, Winona has a number of events coming up. Tonight in San Francisco at the Ferry Plaza Book Passage, she'll be speaking at 5:30. Tomorrow, Berkeley City College at 7:30. On Thursday, she'll be at the Capitola Book Cafe at 7:30. And then on Saturday in Marin, she'll be at the Sunrise Center at 4 o'clock. That's 645 Tamalpais Drive. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Carlisle, calling from Carmel Valley. Hi, Carlisle. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, Rose. I'm from, Monterey County, and basically, we have a multi-billion-dollar food industry here, but we have 11,000 people every week going to our food bank. But the bright part is that we do have ALBA, which is an organic farm incubator, and I'm kind of asking people to actually have face-to-face meetings with your congressman, and in our county would be with Sam Farr, to actually ask them for more organic farm incubators. In every county, and to start through education and business education in these farm incubators. I see that as the outlet, and also the USDA to fund this. These are very expensive enterprises, but eventually they can become sustainable because they actually can sell the produce off the farms. So that's my kind of contribution, and I don't know what your speaker has to say about that, but I'll get off and I'll listen to you guys about that.
Okay, well thank you for calling in, Carlisle. Winona, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think farm incubation is terrific, and it's an important program. I don't think that people just accessing food off the farm, though, is going to serve everybody who we want to have access to good organic food. So where it can be done, fantastic. Sam Farr is a real problem on ag policy. I would love to see people, his constituents, actually go and meet with him and try to hold him accountable. But there's so much consolidation in organics mm-hmm. that farmers really don't have much of an option to sell into that market. And California is a little bit different because there are more people who are educated, who are willing to go out to the farm. This isn't the case everywhere. So when you have one natural food store, Whole Foods, that has a stranglehold on the organics market in most parts of this country,
there aren't a lot of places that are going to take organic produce. And I think what's most shocking to people is the fact that we have one enormous distributor of organic food, produce, and organic products, United Natural Foods, Inc. This company probably has more to do with the high price of organic food than any other company other than Whole Foods, because they actually distribute the produce to the restaurants and to the stores that want to sell it. They have a deal with Whole Foods, so they do a lot of business with Whole Foods. They are a publicly traded company. Now, their acronym is UNFI. And over the last 5 years, they've had an 83% increase in profits, and their profit margin is an average of 18%. They have workers that have been in strike in December in one of their big distribution facilities in Washington State. And this company has a stranglehold on distribution. I was just doing a book signing last week in West Virginia, and someone at who runs an organic deli told me his costs in the late last year have risen 8% from UNFI. And he wants to sell organic products, but he has no one else who can distribute to him. And that's why so many natural food stores and co-ops have closed around the country. Now, here in the Bay Area, you have a lot of choices that people don't have elsewhere.
Right.
And what we really need is for the organics movement, the good food movement here in the Bay Area, to really take on these issues that affect people elsewhere in the country, because this is where the thought leaders are. And what happens in California rolls across the country. We need the thought leaders of the good food movement to start talking about competition and to demand that something be done about it.
Well, and if you are in this movement, I know so many of you are, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on Winona's argument that we need to do more beyond going to our farmers market and, you know, support these farm to food events, which is a good thing to do, but what about what's happening in the rest of the country? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. So you brought up a number of things there, and I'm so glad you mentioned Whole Foods, because Whole Foods CEO John Mackey is in the Bay Area this week. He got a lot of flack for calling President Obama's health care bill fascist. And I'm wondering, he wasn't available to join us this week, but he is going to come back in April. He's launching this sort of conscious capitalism movement. Whole Foods is hoping to have 1,000 stores in the United States in the coming year. Their fourth quarter earnings grew 49% as sales grew to almost $3 billion. They just opened a store near me in Upper Haight, and it's always packed. Traffic is always backed up. It's packed all day long. What are your thoughts on Whole Foods?
Well, first of all, I think it's ironic that he would talk about capitalism, because our economic system is based on the idea that there's competition. So the idea that there's one store that dominates the industry is really contrary to what we're told about capitalism. So, you know, I think that Whole Foods is too big, controls too much of the market. It sells too many conventional foods, because people believe that when they enter the ambiance of a Whole Foods store, that somehow the product is better, even if it's sold down the street in a Kroger's or a Safeway. And they make a lot of money selling conventional products. And I think that this is a problem. I think that the Federal Trade Commission should revisit the issue of Wild Oats Market, their largest competitor, being absorbed. I mean, it shows that the Federal Trade Commission, the agency that is really responsible for ensuring competition, doesn't do its job, because that merger didn't pass the laugh test, and we're now living with the fallout from that merger in having very expensive organic food, because it's been made a gourmet item. And what these food companies do, and the 14 of the largest 20 companies in the processed food companies also dominate organic food, they view organic food as a niche market that they can charge more for, And this isn't really the system that we want. We want healthy, organic food to be available for everyone, not just a few people.
What are your thoughts about the organic companies that are owned by the multinationals? This got a lot of attention because so many of the multinationals were behind Monsanto's effort to kill the GMO labeling law in California, and they succeeded. And a lot of people didn't know that these, what they thought were small organic companies, were in fact owned by multinationals.
Yeah, we're talking about companies like Pepsi, who put money into defeating Prop 37. I mean, it's outrageous. And these companies are also doing everything that they can to weaken the organic standards, which is another place that people who are interested in protecting organic food here in the Bay Area can get involved, because the Organic Standards Board meets regularly. These companies lobby the standards board and try to weaken it. We've had synthetics moved into organic production. We need to do everything that we can to protect the integrity of the organic standard. We all know it's not perfect and that it's been co-opted, but it's the best that we have right now. And we don't want these large companies like Dean Foods, who is the largest of the organic food companies, or Pepsi or Kraft, to step in and
Silk and Horizon Organic brands are both owned by Dean. Silk does the soy milk and coconut milk and almond milk.
Yes, and they have they control about 40% of milk in the United States.
We have an email. Actually, you know, we'll go to emails in just a minute. We've got a number of listeners on the line, so let's go to callers first. Let's hear from William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. As you may know, in the state of Washington, there's now signatures have been collected to put on the ballot the labeling of genetically engineered food. Excuse me, I just have to clear my throat. And we're concerned that many of the companies that donated against our campaign in California to label GMOs will be donating there. And we have the list of the companies. It's available. The list of the companies that donated against us and the names of their products. And one can email those companies to tell them not to donate against the campaign in Washington. And I can give you the website or the who to contact, that's handling the coordination of the campaign.
Okay.
To notify the companies. It's the name is Mark, M-A-R-K, at genatural.com. That's M-A-R-K at genatural.com. And that's the Good Earth Natural Foods Market, and he's coordinating it there. And then you can simply email the companies and say, we're not buying your products because you contributed against the campaign in California.
Right.
And please, we urge you in future not to contribute against such campaigns. And now they're making their decisions, those corporations are, as to whether to contribute against us in the state of Washington, because the signatures have just been submitted. Sorry to go on for so long, but there are things that we can do.
Yeah, thank you. Where do you think the campaign to label GMOs is going in light of what happened here in California?
Well, you know, I think the initiative in Washington is very exciting. We're working on it. We hope that pressure can be brought to bear on these companies, and we should have as much transparency as possible. And I think that being successful with these initiatives means educating people over a period of time. At Food and Water Watch, besides working on the initiative in Washington State, we're working on legislative campaigns in a number of states, because that gives you a little bit more time to actually do the education. Not that we expect to win in the first year, but maybe it'll take 3 or even 5 years. But we need to do the kind of organizing where you're putting pressure on elected leaders to support labeling. And we know that people, even people who support the biotech industry, believe it should be labeled. So I think that the whole movement to label genetically engineered food is exciting because it gives people an avenue, an entry point into working on these issues and beginning to hold these elected leaders responsible.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, William. And today on Your Call, we are joined by Winona Howder. She is Executive Director of Food and Water Watch. She's out with a new book, Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. We're talking about the corporate control of our food system and what needs to be done about it. We're not just talking about the massive factory farms. We're also talking about what we think of as small organic companies. And again, Winona will be speaking at the Ferry Plaza Book Passage tonight at 5:30. Tomorrow, Berkeley City College at 7:30. Thursday, Capitola Book Cafe at 7:30. And on Saturday, she'll be at the Sunrise Center in Corte Madera at 4 o'clock. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. We have just over 10 minutes left, and if you'd like to weigh in on what we're currently facing with our food supply, if you've got any questions about, there's so much going on right now with everything from food safety to GMOs. There's always usually something in the news when it comes to food. So what questions do you have for Winona, and what are your thoughts about her argument that those of us who appreciate the local food movement in Northern California really need to do more to make sure that everyone has access to this kind of healthy food? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Jennifer in Monterey. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi there. I'm actually on my way from Monterey to Santa Cruz right now. But I wanted to address the issue of distribution, because a previous caller from Monterey mentioned Alga, which is an organic farm incubator, but also a distributor. And my understanding about their business model as a nonprofit is to not just facilitate the growth of new farmers, but to give them a market for their product, because I understand that to be a big issue with organic farming. Is it's great if you can get up and running, but you need to have a market for your product, and you need to be able to distribute it. So what about that model of creating collective distribution entities so that individual small organic farmers can pool their resources into a distribution facility or partner? And then my second question, which is totally different or topic I'd like addressed, is the food in schools, because that seems to be the thing that sets us up for a lifetime of patterns in terms of our choices. And it seems like a no-brainer for the food movement to be partnering with schools if we want to change our fundamental system in our relationship to a sustainable food system.
Thank you.
Great. Well, as far as the farm incubation and making a nonprofit co-op, I think it's fantastic where it works, and it can work in some places. But all of these enterprises that I'm familiar with have taken foundation money. They take support. And so that's wonderful where it's available, but it's not available everywhere. And so we actually want a marketplace that works too. It doesn't mean that we don't want both. We want the nonprofit and the foundation support where there are people who can offer it. But we want a marketplace that farmers can sell into and actually get their food to market, and that people in the region and locally will have access to it. To actually achieve that, we need to deal with a marketplace that's too consolidated and that has a few big players who dominate, whether it's Walmart, where one out of three grocery dollars are spent, and where the Walmart heirs have more wealth than for the 40% of the of Americans, 40% of the lowest income Americans. I mean, there's something wrong with that system.
And I want to just ask you very briefly, Michelle Obama in January 2011 stood on stage with Walmart executives to tout their healthy food campaign. It's the first time that a first lady has given her name to a corporation. What did you think of that?
Well, I thought it wasn't a great idea, because I've heard some food advocates talk about Walmart actually re-regionalizing the food system. And one of the things I did in writing Foodopoly is to really study the Walmart model. And it is based on squeezing every bit of profit out of their suppliers. And there is no way that in the long term that they could be beneficial for the food system. They're the largest buyer of agricultural goods. to sell to Walmart, you have to be very large and have a lot of volume. And so I think that their whole program touting sustainability is really greenwashing of the worst kind.
Well, what you hear from a lot of environmentalists is that because Walmart is so big, if they do make changes, it would create a massive ripple effect across the industry, whether it's taking some sort of steps for energy or bringing organic food into the stores.
Right, but Walmart isn't going to drastically change their system. They're always going to have large trucks traveling long distances. They're going to continue to sell many products produced in China from petroleum, and they are making a mockery of organics by dealing with the very largest companies in the country. I mean, we don't want a food system where 80% of the greens grown are grown in two counties in California. That doesn't make sense. And Walmart needs volume. They forced companies to use their logistical systems, their IT departments. It's all about logistics with Walmart, and it's about being profitable. It is very doubtful that they would ever want to deal with many small farmers. I mean, they want to deal with the largest meat packers and the largest companies to source these products because it's easier and more profitable.
Oh, we have a question about organics from David in Santa Cruz. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hey, welcome. Your guest is right on about when people walk into Whole Foods and they think everything's organic in there. But I'm from Santa Cruz, you know, organic capital of the planet. I was trained as a California certified organic inspector 28 years ago. I just want to tell you that food producers cannot get enough organic product to make what they want. I have a company here. I love their organic chocolate covered raisins. They also have a conventional packet. And I asked the owner of the company, I go, why don't you just make it all organic chocolate covered raisins? He said, I would, David, but I can't get enough product. This is why organic command such a high price, because there's just simply not enough on the market to bring the price down. Now, if every farmer in America went organic, that would change the equation, but it's a three-year transition period to get all the pesticides out of the dirt. So it's not an issue of the, you know, they're duping us. It commands a high price because of scarcity. There's just not enough organic product on the market to even supply the producers with it, with the stuff to make it. So, well, the Whole Foods of the world have to sell conventional. If it was only organic stuff on their shelf, you know, three quarters of it would be empty.
Well, I think that, again, it's the problem that farmers have in getting their product to market, because there just isn't a way. There's no market for, let's look at soy and how many of the farmers who were growing soy went out of business because Dean Foods decided that silk would not be organic anymore. Raisin growers. I talked to a number of raisin growers in the Central Valley in writing Foodopoly. Raisin growers who wanted to grow organically, they don't have someone, a shipper and packer, who is actually going to pay the price and then get it to market. This has to do with a system that is unfair in how farm products actually reach the companies that want to make the products. So I think that Whole Foods selling conventional food goes way beyond organic products not being available. It has to do with price, and it has to do with how that food is supplied to the marketplace.
What strikes you about the Obama administration and where it stands on these issues?
Well, I don't think the Obama administration wants to tackle these issues. They had an opportunity to tackle the unfairness in livestock. They had an opportunity last year, and they blew it, because livestock growers are going out of business, the family farms. In fact, we have almost no family farms that grow hogs any longer, because they just simply have no market to sell into. And they chickened out because the meat industry ran ads and called them names and said it was going to cost jobs. And so they didn't follow through and actually change the rules at the Department of Justice and at the USDA to make these markets competitive.
We've got 2 minutes left, Winona Howder, and I just wonder, can you You have the end chapter is the way forward. What is your vision, given the political climate, given just the how big things like Whole Foods and Walmart, these stores are, these massive corporations are? What is your vision? What do you want?
My vision is that people have to know what the problems are, and then there has to be a discussion and a debate in society. And so far, we're not having a discussion about the consolidation, and it's not just in the food industry, and it's having an impact all across our economic system, reducing wages, making fewer jobs. And so I think that that's where we have to start. But we have to start step by step with labeling genetically engineered food, working at the state level on state-related issues. For instance, fracking. Fracking is happening in many areas because farmers can't make a living from their land any longer. And so the extractive industries move in. And working at these state-level issues is very important because at the state level, these are the people who, in the state legislatures, who come up with the congressional districts and gerrymander them and make it so difficult to do anything federally. So I think we have to start at the beginning with our local organizing, and we have to have the long view. It will probably take 30 more years, maybe 50 years, to fix farm bill policies. But, you know, it took 50 years to stop child labor in the United States. And so I think we have to do this step by step, and there's no replacement for grassroots organizing.
And so you think that the most effective thing we can do is to really work at the state level,
state and local level, yeah. And that will allow us to do federal work. If we pass state legislation on GMO labeling in 15 states, we'll get a federal bill.
Winona Howder is author of Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America, executive director of Food and Water Watch. You can find out about her events in San Francisco, Berkeley, Capitola, and Corte Madera at our website, yourcallradio.org. Thank you, Winona.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks for your phone calls and emails. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. How has the status of reproductive rights changed over the last four decades? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with activists who work on the front lines of reproductive justice. This year marks the 40th anniversary of the historic Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion in the United States. Even though the majority support abortion, state laws restricting it are on the rise. Why? And what are the realities for women seeking abortions 40 years after Roe v. Wade? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihei Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.